Noon. This from the ECB. This call is provided for invited market analysts as an aid to understanding the results published today to inform your analysis of the results. Please note that the purpose of the call is to discuss and further explain what is published today and in the ECB report and how the ECB undertook the bank-by-bank analysis. The ECB would not normally discuss individual institutions, so only information in the report can be discussed. We will not enter into commentary on this call about individual institutions or the decision-making processes. Today's call is hosted by Jukka Vesala, Project Manager for the Comprehensive Assessment and Director General, and John Fell, Acting Director General, who led the stress testing exercise for the ECB. They are both joined by experts from their teams who will answer your questions on both topics. We will start with a short presentation, which will take about 25 minutes. The team of experts are here for an hour to take questions. The PowerPoint slide accompanying this presentation should already be visible on your screens. If you cannot see this presentation now, please email expert_visit@ecb.europa.eu. That's expert_visit@ecb.europa.eu. And a copy will be sent to you straight away. After this, we will take calls. You will be introduced by the moderator. To facilitate the smooth running of the call, we will take one question per institution. You may then queue again to ask further questions via the call host, Mia. I will now turn to Jukka first to give a very brief overview.
Thank you very much, Jill, and good afternoon on my behalf. I will go through the overall comprehensive assessment results and asset quality review results, and then John will discuss the stress test and the join-up results. Starting with some of the key findings of the exercise, the headline figures, we find in the asset quality review that there is a gross impact on asset values at 48 billion euro. So this is the impact of the new provisions that we would see banks in need of having from a prudential perspective. A big part of these provisions will also have an accounting impact. Another key figure coming out of the asset quality review exercise is that we find that there is an additional 136 billion of euros of non-performing exposures, and this is a major contribution of the exercise, as we were using for the first time a very consistent definition of the non-performing exposures. And I will talk about a little bit more about this point in the AQR presentation. Then when one looks at the overall impact of the comprehensive assessment, taking into account the AQR impact and then the stress test impact, in the adverse scenario, we find that the bank's capital, the capital of all the 130 banks, is reduced by 263 billion euros in the adverse horizon of the 3 years. This means when one takes a median bank in our set of banks, a reduction in the CET1 ratio of 4 percentage points. So banks fall from roughly 12.4% to 8.4%. Then when we look at the banks that would be needing additional capital because of the exercise, we have an overall figure of 25 billion roughly of capital shortfall, taking into account all the elements of the comprehensive assessment, and this shortfall is found in 25 banks. But this is a shortfall on a gross basis when we take into account the new capital issuance that banks have raised since the beginning of the year. This number of 25 is reduced to 13, so these 13 banks have additional work to do to cover the capital shortfalls, and they will have to present by 10th of November a plan how to cover the capital shortfall to the SSM, the new supervisor, starting the 4th of November. On slide 5, we have a breakdown of the shortfall of 25 billion, and you can see here that the impact is coming quite equally from the stress test and the AQR, The stress test calculations deliver 11.2 billion of capital shortfall, and this already includes the impact of the ECB quality assurance, which has been a very important feature of the exercise. Through the quality assurance, we have been making sure that the bank's submissions of the stress tests meet the methodological requirements and meet the quality standards that we would like to have in the exercise. And then roughly 11 billion is coming from the AQR contribution, and when we then add also the impact of the join-up, that is the impact of the AQR to the loss projections of the banks, we come up to the 25 billion of overall gross shortfall. This shortfall is spread across 11 countries out of the 19 countries we have in the exercise. The euro area countries currently plus Lithuania who joined the exercise. And on this slide 6, you can see in relative terms the size of the shortfall identified. The shortfall is presented as a percentage of the risk-weighted assets. You can see, so you can see directly the impact on the CET1 ratio. And the impact is highest in Cyprus and Greece. However, as we have noted in the disclosures, two Greek banks that have a shortfall don't have a shortfall anymore when we take the dynamic balance sheet assumption. Then we have also relevant shortfalls in both Portugal, Italy, Slovenia, Ireland, Austria and Belgium. Regarding the Slovenian banks and the Belgian bank Dexia, there is also footnoting in the report noting that these shortfalls have been mitigated significantly by restructuring means. You can see a closer explanation in the report. I mentioned the overall impact of 4 percentage points when one looks at the median bank CET1 ratio from the whole exercise. And you can see here on slide 7 the impact by countries, and the impact is highest in Slovenia. You have a significant impact in the median bank, and then and Greece and Cyprus. This comparison is interesting in the sense that this metrics also can be used as an indicator of the severity of the entire exercise. When we compare to the US CCAR exercise in 2014, the median change was 2.9% each points, and in the Spain, the previous AQR and the stress test exercise, 2.1. So our 4 percentage points compares quite well against these exercises, for instance, and gives an indication of the strength of our exercise. In the IBA 2011 stress test, the median change was 2.1 percentage point. I'd like to highlight once more that the fact that we had this stringent quality assurance on both the AQR and the stress test made a big difference now in our exercise, in making the impact of the both elements more severe. Now if I can turn to the asset quality review results, we go to slide 9. Here you have an overview of the asset quality review findings by main work blocks. You can see that, first of all, 16.4 billion is coming in the credit file review in the specific provisions in the file by file review of the bank's portfolios. And then we can add 10.3 based on the extrapolation of provisions. So these are the individually assessed provisions, and especially the specific provisions, 16.4 billion, is something that could be reflected also in the accounts. The projection of findings is more purely prudential measure. And then collective provisions, we find additional provision needs of 16.2 billion. And then when one looks at the fair value exposure review, we have relatively smaller impact of 4.6 billion. Then we make a distinction between the total AQR cross impact and then the impact after taxes and guarantees. And this offsetting impact of taxes and guarantees is 13.8, so we have a net impact at 33.8 billion of euros of the AQR. I mentioned as a major finding of the AQR the increase in the non-performing exposures by 136 billion euros. We started from a stock of non-performing exposures of 743 billion. That means that we had an 18% increase in non-performing exposures. Of this 136 billion, 55 billion comes from the harmonized definition that we applied. So this is the contribution of us moving to a harmonized definition, which we call the simplified EBA definition, 90 days past due or impaired or unlikely to pay. And then the credit file review found additional 81 billion of non-performing exposures, and so we come to the 136 billion. We very much want to underline this part of the exercise because this is really the contribution of the increased consistency and comparability, and we think this was a major step forward in terms of providing consistency and transparency in banks' conditions. Here on slide 10, you can also see the asset classes where the increase in non-performing exposures has been the largest. It has been largest in large SMEs and real estate-related individually assessed files, and in collectively assessed files, we have residential real estate. The fact that the collectively assessed retail portfolios show relatively less increase in non-performing exposures is partly due to the fact that in these portfolios, the 90 days past due criterion was more widely used. We also find in the exercise that forbearance is an important driver as well, and we found this information in our loan tapes and the data integrity validation exercises, and we defined forbearance as cases where there was a change in the repayment schedule of the loans that was more favorable to the client, or where the change was due to the weakening of the financial condition of the borrower. So this aspect of capturing forbearance is also an important part of these findings. Then if one goes to the impact on provisions that I already mentioned, the 48 billion in total AQR adjustments, we have 43 billion coming from the credit file review and the collectively assessed exposures. And you can see here again that the provisioning changes have been greatest in large SMEs and real estate related in the individually assessed. And I would also pick out shipping, where we had a 25% increase in the provisioning needs in the exercise. I would like to highlight very much what we have been already speaking in various occasions, the importance of quality assurance in the area of AQR. We have a difference. Can you change the slides that they are? I'm on slide 12 already. Excuse me, we had a technical glitch here. Okay. So I'm on slide 12. I hope you were not lost in this technical problem. On slide 12, we have highlighted the quality assurance in the asset quality review, and that is a very important aspect of the exercise, also in the stress test area. In the asset quality review, the quality assurance was conducted by both the NCAs, firstly looking at their audit results independently, and then importantly also centrally by the ECB. And we were in a strong position to do this centralized quality assurance because we had a very extensive data set coming out of the exercise on around 190,000 individual debtors, and we were able to provide cross-country and within-country consistency checks using this database, and we were also performing spot checks on the individual portfolios to see that the requirements of the methodology were used. On this slide 12, we have an example of this quality assurance where we looked at the impairment triggers. Here you can see as a dark blue bar the impact of the impairment triggers as coming out from the NCA work. So there were 3% of the exposures that were still classified as performing, even though more than two or more impairment triggers were hit. And after our quality assurance, this number was reduced to 2.7%. But however, the impact has been larger in individual countries and individual banks. You can see here as an example that in one bank, our quality assurance on the impairment triggers reduced the amount of performing debtors that had more than two impairment triggers hit from 12.3% to 6.3%. So this quality assurance has been, in some cases, very important, increasing and making sure that the results are conservative and consistent. The same idea about the impact of the centralized quality assurance on slide 13 regarding collateral haircuts. Here at the level of the SSM average, we increased through the central quality assurance the haircuts by 1.5 percentage points, but when one looks at individual countries or individual banks, you can find a much more significant impact of the quality assurance that we conducted. Slide 14 shows the breakdown of the collective provisioning findings, 16 billion, where we found that roughly 10 billion was coming from the IBNR part of the provisions and 6 billion coming from the specific provisions under the collective provisioning area. Again, quality assurance played an important role. We had, as you know, a challenger model developed in the manual for the asset quality review, which then provided consistency for the assessment of the collective provisions, and this was a new element of the exercise where we provided consistent findings. And here we have an example of how this consistency was provided. We had as a common assumption for all the banks that the emergency period for collective provisions should be 12 months, meaning the lip factor of one, and if there was a deviation from this, then it was analyzed case by case. There was an application to have a deviation, and then we checked whether the data is supporting this deviation, and then we had some cases of banks where there was a shorter emergence period, but still these were relatively a few. On the right-hand side of slide 15, you can see another aspect of this quality assurance, which was the use of the fallback assumptions for the key parameters. And you can see here that when one used the bank models, what was the outcome of banks' own analysis, we are not that far from the fallbacks. But if there was a case that we were not satisfied with the quality of the bank's own models, we were then using the fallback parameters that are mentioned here, for instance, on this slide. Finally, the final work block of the asset quality review, the review of fair value exposures. We looked at the non-derivative exposures and then the derivative exposures in terms of the quality of the pricing models, and then we looked at the impact of the CVA adjustments. The non-derivative exposures and the CVA adjustments we looked at for all of the 130 banks, and then the derivative pricing models we concentrated on 20 most sophisticated banks that have important exposures. And there it was perhaps not that surprising that we found that there was not big impact, because the derivative models in the sophisticated banks should be in line with market standards, otherwise they would be losing money. But I think the important contribution from this workbook was that we really put the CVA adjustments for all sorts of instruments on a consistent basis. Now I would like to hand over to John to move to the stress testing side.
And just in case anybody's experiencing a time delay in seeing the slides, such as maybe being experienced again, you can request them from expert_visit@ecb.europa.eu. Thank you. Over to John.
Okay. Thank you very much. So I'm going to just go very quickly through the main highlights of the stress test results, and also the contribution of the so-called join-up to the overall exercise results. So to begin with this slide 17, Jukka showed a slide 5, which was the net impacts of the various pieces and their contribution to the capital shortfall. What we have here is the gross impact, so to speak, of the exercise, also decomposed across a number of different elements. In total, the total adverse scenario capital depletion is 263 billion, as you can read from the headline, and that's decomposed into a contribution of 34 from the AQR, 182 from the stress test, and 47 from risk-weighted assets. Now, I'm going to just make a couple of points on, first, the risk-weighted assets impact, which I think is important. You might have the very valid question, why would risk-weighted assets be having an impact on an exercise where the bulk of the banks in the exercise have to follow a static balance sheet assumption? Well, the fact is that the scenario will lead to an increase in risk parameters, probabilities of default and so on, and that will create an additional capital need. And you can see from that slide that the impact of that in the adverse scenario is actually quite material. It's 47 billion. Another point that I think is important to make is the asset quality review contribution to the gross figure looks kind of small relative to the capital depletion from the stress test. But it's very important, I think, and I think this is one of the elements of this exercise which sets it apart from all other exercises that have been done at an EU-wide level or euro area level, and that is the way in which the AQR impacts on the stress test. The AQR impact on the total gross figure is larger than that 34 that you see on the slide, and that's because of the way in which we did the so-called join-up. The join-up between the asset quality review and the stress test affects not only the starting points, it changes the end 2013 balance sheet positions, but it also, the discoveries in the AQR also have carried through into the dynamics of the stress test as well. And in fact, we documented this in the Comprehensive Assessment Stress Test Manual, where we delineated between two possible channels through which the AQR can impact on the stress test. One is on the so-called new information effect, meaning essentially that the probabilities of default of loan portfolios at the end of 2013 can be raised, and that can mean that the starting point PDs are higher, and so they can, the impact of the scenario on those risk parameters can be more magnified than would have been the case if an asset quality review had not been carried out. The other effect is the so-called portfolio improvement effect, which essentially means when you remove non-performing assets out of the portfolios that were examined, you could be left with portfolios that are on average better. They might be smaller, but they might be better than they were before the asset quality review was carried out. So there are two essentially opposing impacts that can be taking place, and it was always an empirical question which one of these two effects would dominate. We found that the new information effect dominated the portfolio improvement effect. We have a total join-up impact embedded within that 182, which is shown in the middle bar, of 12 billion. Now, just some details then on the way in which we get to the various figures. Slide 19 here is showing a waterfall chart which shows how different accounting items impact on the starting point capital over the 3 years of the exercise. Here we have the baseline. A first important point against which to condition all of the subsequent assessment and analysis is the starting point is very high. The weighted average mean CET1 ratio for all of the banks that participated in the exercise was 11.8%. Now, overall in the baseline, capital depletion from administrative expenses, loan losses, et cetera, is more than offset by the increase in net interest income, net fee and commission income, and trading income. So overall in the baseline, the weighted average core equity tier one ratio rises by 0.2 percentage points, so from up from 11.8 to 12. The next slide does exactly the same analysis, but here we have for the stress scenario, capital depletion is 3 percentage points of the CET1, leaving the N2016 weighted average capital level well above the 5.5% threshold. So, in fact, on average, more than 3 percentage points higher than the overall threshold for the exercise. Capital erosion relative to the baseline is essentially coming from three items, which can be seen from making a comparison between this slide and the previous one. Net interest income, which is 1 percentage point lower than in the baseline, loan losses, which are 2 percentage points higher, and the additional capital need created by the increase in risk-weighted assets, which I explained, which is 0.5 percentage points higher than in the baseline. That comparison is made on this slide, and I think the only additional piece of information relative to what I've said already is that here there are some other offsetting impacts that are coming from, for example, taxes, dividends are overall lower than in the baseline because, of course, in the adverse taxes, the profits are lower than they are in the baseline. That impact is 0.9 percentage point offset. Now, I'm going to have a couple of charts just looking at the decomposition of the various drivers, just looking at distributions across all of the banks that participated in the exercise, and I'm going to use this analytical device for the next four slides. It's a box plot, and basically what it is showing, just to explain very quickly what the box plots are, red dots are the median for all of the banks in the sample, grey areas are the interquartile range, and the blue horizontal bars denote essentially the outliers, the 10% and the 90% percentiles. On this chart, loan losses are decomposed across five portfolios for both the baseline and for the adverse scenario. As was shown in the waterfall chart, in the baseline, there's 2.4 percentage points of CET1 that is lost, and that is coming primarily from the corporate and other retail portfolios. In the stress, corporate and other retail portfolios are also, well, they're performing worse than they are in the baseline, and also the mortgage portfolios are performing quite poorly as well, which is natural given the setup of the scenario that we had that had large house price shocks embedded in the scenarios of many countries. This chart is showing a decomposition of net interest income. The units are year-by-year percentage changes, also box plots across all of the banks that are in the exercise. And here, baseline and adverse are lined up against one another year-by-year. It's important to recall that the EBA methodology caps net interest income at the N2013 level for those banks that are carrying out the exercise under a static balance sheet assumption, so there cannot be any increases in the first year. You do see on that chart increases in the second year, but they're basically coming from offset from the declines in the first year, as the impact of the scenario unwinds. If those of you familiar with the scenario will recall that there's a very sharp increase in long-term interest rates in the first year of the scenario, which decays later on, and that is the same for the pattern of spreads as well, sovereign spreads across the scenario and the funding shock and so on. But in general, the net interest income in the adverse scenario is almost always lower than it is in the baseline, and you can see that not only for the medians but also for the entire distribution. So the distributions are skewed more to the downside for the adverse than they are for the baseline for each of the years of the exercise. Going then into the decomposition of risk-weighted assets, the unit of measurement here in this slide is the percentage change in the nominal amount. Risk-weighted assets increase in both the baseline and in the adverse, but they do so more in the adverse than in the baseline. Now, while the adverse impact is large, it was in one of the first slides that I showed, on average, some changes are very large. So you can see, for example, for the 90th percentile, the horizontal bar in the first year under the adverse is showing 16% in some cases. So some risk-weighted asset impacts on capital are very, very large indeed. The stress test impact, one question that often comes when adopting the static balance sheet assumption in an exercise, people often say that, well, banks will always do better if they have a dynamic balance sheet than if they have a static balance sheet assumption, that it confers a benefit, because in a stress test, where the balance sheet is held constant, it's effectively preventing banks from what they would optimally like to do in a stress scenario, to deleverage and to avoid some of the capital costs of an adverse scenario. And so the argument would be that because they're not allowed to do that, a static balance sheet assumption makes the whole exercise tougher. This chart is looking at the comparison for both adverse, for baseline and adverse, decomposed across both the static and dynamic balance sheet banks in the exercise. Overall, you can see that there is no clear evidence that banks who have an exemption from the static balance sheet do better than banks that do not. In the baseline, they do better, but in the adverse, they do worse. Now, of course, that the worst performance in the adverse of the dynamic balance sheet banks is essentially because these are banks that have agreed restructuring banks. They are weak banks already, so one would expect that they would perform, that they would be more challenged by such an exercise than the ones that are not going through restructuring. Now, I'm just going to have a couple of concluding slides very, very quickly on the impact of the join-up, because I think it's important just to mention a few points about it, because this is one of the value added of the exercise in combination with the asset quality review. The Comprehensive Assessment Stress Test Manual that we published in early August made clear that the join-up would only have an impact on the overall comprehensive assessment outcome if the asset quality review had a material impact. Now, in keeping with this, the asset quality review impacts are shown on the horizontal axis of this chart, and the join-up impacts are shown on the vertical. And there you can see at the intersection of the X and the Y axis that banks that had no AQR impact had no join-up impact either, and banks that had large AQR impacts had large join-up impact as well. On the next slide, where did the join-up have its main impact in the exercise? This is a decomposition. The Comprehensive Assessment Stress Test Manual identified several channels through which the impact of joining the asset quality review to the stress test could be felt in the overall exercise. And it was always an empirical question, ultimately, which one of these channels would be the most important ones. This chart is showing the empirical outcome for each of the different channels, and as you can see in the baseline, the main impact is coming from impairments on financial assets, with some impacts with some offsets coming from some other items to give a total of 6 billion. And then in the adverse scenario, the story is essentially the same, just the figures are larger. The greatest contribution to the total join-up impact is coming from impairment on financial assets. But then finally, just in terms of putting all of that into perspective, The overall gross impact of the exercise are shown in bold under total CET1 impact on this slide 29, 43 billion in the baseline and 181 in the adverse. Those figures should be compared with the 6 billion, which would have made the baseline six billion better without the join-up, and the adverse would have been 12 billion better without these join-up impacts. So the join-up impacts overall are not really decisive for the overall exercise. So that would conclude my part of the presentation.
Okay, thank you very much, John. We will now open up the call to questions. Please address your query to John Odioka, and they will also be aided by experts on their teams on the respective elements of the exercise. Mia, can you please open the line?
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time we will begin the question and answer session. Anyone who has a question may press star followed by one at this time. To withdraw your question, please press star followed by two. And the first question is from the line of Ewan Stennis of Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, John and team. Thanks very much, Steve, for the call today. Two questions. I'm very interested in what you perceive to be the sort of supervisory reaction function to the test today. I suppose in two ways. One would be for those banks who passed, but maybe by less than 1 to 1.5%, how will the ECB consider those passes qualitatively, and will they be, given in some cases they may have benefited from the phase-in rules, will that be an area of focus? And in particular, point two, how will you tie in the results today quantitatively and qualitatively to the dividend decisions of the banks? For instance, if a bank has passed but qualitatively it's benefited from DTAs or goodwill, will, again, that have an impact on the way you interact with banks once the SSM set up and consider dividend policies? Thank you.
There will be a process that starts after the 10th of November once the banks have submitted the capital plans. They will be evaluated by the joint supervisory teams, and the issues that you mentioned will be addressed. As you might know, the banks have more means available to meet the capital shortfalls than what is just the new capital raised or a new COCOs raised, if those can be used within the limits of the exercise. Banks can also use retained earnings. They can use asset sales and some other means that are quite clearly defined also in our public communication. So the issue of the dividends is linked, of course, to the issue of the retained earnings. And one of the tools that is available to the supervisors is to limit the distribution of earnings to the owners. But it's very difficult at this stage to comment on the individual banks, and we are not in the position to do that, because now I would expect that the banks will be coming out with their own plans how to cover the shortfalls if there is a gap to be covered, and then the means that are explained by the banks will be carefully evaluated by the supervisor, and then we will have clarity on what is the actual gap that the banks will need to cover over the time period that we have set out. So within the next 9 months, if the shortfall, as it's the case in the majority of cases, is coming from the adverse scenario of the stress test.
Thank you very much. Can I just ask one supplementary? So, but if I get back to the quality of capital versus quantity of capital, if the bank has passed more through DTAs and goodwill, will that specifically be taken account of in the review as the process gets started? And number two, maybe on the ECB press conference a couple of hours ago, there's a mention that stress testing may take place in the future without any clarity about whether A, it would be public, and B, whether it be annual. Again, any comment on any policy decisions you've already made about when and how the future stress tests can be done? So quality and quantity and future stress tests. Thanks.
Well, the quality of capital is an important issue, and we cover that also quite extensively in the aggregated report of the exercise. We have conducted the exercise under the constraints of the legal requirements. We, of course, have to honor the transitional arrangements that have been set in the transition to fully-fledged CRD4 CRR rules. And that transition is fully taken into account in the capital plans and the possibilities for banks. For instance, the possibility of deducting somewhat less of the items that you mentioned, like DTAs, is a legal fact, and that has to be taken into account. But then these deductions will be phased out over the course of the time. So this is the, let's say, the pillar one legal side. But then, of course, the SSM has, as the supervisor, the pillar two means to address weaknesses in the quality of capital, and that will be done. The elements what we consider weak will be addressed through the pillar two measures. And also the SSM can, after the start of November, start work to harmonize the national options that are in the remit of the competent authorities, as the SSM will become the national competent authority, that can then decide on certain national options that determine the quality of capital. And we will be doing that in the SSM as a matter of priority.
Thank you.
Next question is from the line of Alistair Ryan of Bank of America. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Just to clarify on the additional NPLs that you've identified, the additional impairment provisions that might be considered appropriate and capital actions, quite a number of the banks are already suggesting to us they might not feel the need to take those NPLs into their balance sheet or the impairment provisions through their P&L or their capital actions, you know, through raising equity. Now, clearly, that's, you know, banks will always want to do that. What would be your ambitions for how these things actually play through in banks' accounts and in banks' actions? Or is it, you know, the extent of this exercise is to identify the numbers and then, you know, the market will make what it wants of them? Thank you.
I don't think you put very accurately the nature of the exercise. Nature of the exercise is not to put out numbers to the market, and the market will think what to do with it. We have really come up with the clear numbers that are linked to our assessment of the capital needs of the banks in a prudential perspective. So we identified the number of non-performing exposures that should be identified, and then, as I went through in the presentation, number of provisions, 43 billion to be precise, that are linked to the these non-performing exposures and linked to the work blocks of the asset quality review that were addressing the provisioning needs, credit file review or the collective provisions. We have not been able to say what part of these provisions should be reflected in the accounts, but there are certain work blocks in the exercise, like the specific provisions in the credit file review, that should have an accounting implication. And as a matter of priority, the SSM new supervisory teams will go through the findings of the asset quality review together with the banks and their auditors, and to see what should be the impact on the banks' accounts. But the whole exercise is clearly a capital adequacy exercise, and we have identified those banks that should be adding their capital on the basis of the AQR and the stress test.
That's it. Thank you. Just so if I can just ask you to be specific, please. Would you expect banks to recognise your characterisation of NPLs as NPLs? Would you expect them to take the impairment provisions that you've identified? And would you expect them to raise equity against the identified capital shortfall, please? Thank you.
Well, on the latter question, we have already defined that the capital shortfall should be covered by common equity or corresponding instruments that qualify as CET1 instruments. We have allowed, if the shortfall is coming from the adverse scenario, 1% point of risk-weighted assets to be covered, that part of the shortfall, by the additional Tier 1 instruments, for instance, COCOs. And the acceptance is based on the trigger level. So that part is clear. And what I said previously, other measures like asset sales or retained earnings can also be taken into account. But regarding the direct impact of the AQR on the accounts, it's not possible for us to say at this stage. It will be a bank-by-bank evaluation in a supervisory process, but we expect that that a significant part of the findings should be reflected in the accounts.
Thank you. Just one more if I may. Page 139 of your document sounds like you're unhappy with the DTAs that national authorities have used. Once you're the SSM, would you hope to be able to change the way that that works? 237, sorry.
The DTAs are dependent on future profitability are subject to, they are legally recognized as part of the capital base, but they are subject to the phasing in. So the share of the DTAs can be in the capital base is reduced over time. And then there are other types of DTAs that have been converted into assets. They are not subject to phase in, and they will remain the bank's capital base.
Thank you.
And the next question is from Janesh O'Mahon of Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Hello, Jukka and John from my side as well. So I have one question. I'm looking at the EBA release, which is very helpful, summary of bank level results. And Jukka, I want to ask you, from your position of a future supervisor of the Eurozone banks, when the European Banking Authority tells us that a bank has passed the stress test on the basis of the current definition of the hurdle rate, but has failed heavily on the basis of fully loaded definitions, how should we think about that? And how do you expect the banks and the markets to think about that as well? And as a related question to this, you've given us very helpfully the leverage ratios and the leverage exposures, but obviously you've left for us to calculate the post-stress leverage ratios ourselves. How does that feed into the way you think about capitalization of these institutions? Thanks.
It should be very clear that the capital shortfall is calculated under the capital rules that are in place 1st of January 2014 in the transition in the implementation of the CRR and CRD4, and then when we look at the time frame ahead in the stress test, taking into account the transitional arrangements. We are not calculating the shortfall on the basis of the fully loaded, because that is an imaginary figure. We are following the capital shortfall of the banks based on the legal requirements, as I mentioned. However, we do recognize, of course, that some banks have a way to go in terms of currently meeting what would be the impact of the fully fledged, and that is also disclosed in our report. But again, it is very clear that that the official capital requirement is not based on the fully fledged.
No, so I mean, but that I understand. No, but from my, so let me ask you the question differently. You have two banks; they have both passed the test. One of them has a fully loaded post-stress capital ratio of 6.5, and the other one has a fully loaded post-stress ratio of 4%. In your view, as the future supervisor of these two institutions, you believe that their capitalization is adequate for both of them?
Well, I mean, supervision will be starting now, and of course, as one of the aspects of supervision, there will be the monitoring of how banks meet the increasing regulatory requirements in the phase-in, so that is part of the normal process. And the supervisor will, of course, have to be sure that the banks are able to meet the upcoming regulatory requirements, so that we need to have capital planning in the banks in good shape to be able to meet the requirements. But the capital plans that we are talking about now are based on the starting of the 14 regulations and then what happens until N16 in terms of the phasing requirements. You mentioned the leverage ratio, and that is basically there for transparency purposes. It's not part of the metrics that has been used to determine the capital shortfall.
But I understand that too. But from your perspective, as a future supervisor, if a bank passes your stress test but shows a very low leverage ratio, does that concern you or not at all?
I think we are getting now into the area of the supervisory practices in the SSM, and I think I'm not in the position to speak about this any further than what I already said.
All right. Thank you very much.
If you'd like to ask a question, please press star followed by one. The next question is from the line of Corinne Cunningham of Autonomous. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Just want to follow up from something that Victor Constantio said earlier on today, and he said that post-stress tests, that we shouldn't think that banks are holding back credit supply anymore. But in a couple of weekends' time, we're due to have another regulatory discussion on total loss absorbing capacity. Do you expect that could hold back bank credit supply, even if the stress test perhaps doesn't?
Corinne, could you repeat the second part of the question? I didn't get the second part of what you asked.
Yeah, so Mr. Constantio this morning said that post-stress tests, banks shouldn't be viewed as holding back credit supply in Europe, so in other words, holding back growth. In a couple of weekends' time, the G20 is going to start talking about total loss-absorbing capacity. Would you expect that to have the potential to hold back credit supply from banks?
On the latter, I don't have any impact assessment that I could draw on to answer the question. I'm looking at the experts in the room. I don't think we have any specific study to refer to this, unfortunately.
Thank you.
Next question is from the line of Alberto Gallo of RBS. Please go ahead. Mr. Gallo, we cannot hear you. Can you please unmute your phone?
Hi, is that better?
Yes, thank you.
So early in the presentation, you showed the sovereign adjustment under the aggregated joint test was about 0.3% to common equity tier 1. Can you give some more information about how you calculated that, please, and how you're going to view any potential sovereign, under the SSM structure? How any future sovereign carry trades might be viewed.
This is Maciej Grodzicki, ECB. I worked on the market risk and sovereign methodology. So the answer on how the numbers on the sovereign AFS and FBO were calculated is fairly simple. There was a set of mark-to-market losses, if you wish, per country and maturity that all banks were asked to implement. And then interest rate hedges were given due recognition where they existed and where they were properly documented. And then at the end of the day, we came up with a figure of 28 billion capital impact, and that comes after a harmonized rule on removal of prudential filters on the AFS book. That's all very well described in the methodology. I think on the way forward, I'd switch back to you, Ken.
It's not fair that I get all these difficult questions. Well, if I understood the question correctly, I would say that this is part of the, let's say, the risk-based supervisory approach that we will be taking on, and we will be looking at the risk like any other risk, also taking into account the findings of the stress test, but then monitoring this on an ongoing basis.
Okay, thanks very much.
Next question is from the line of Roberto Henricus of JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Yuka. Good afternoon, John. Thank you very much for the call. I just had two very quick questions. One was with regard to jurisdictions where legislation for deferred tax assets has only been introduced or implemented in 2014. I just wanted to know if that is going to be eligible to be included in the restructuring measures which some of the institutions which have failed the adverse scenario, if that's going to be contemplated in that. And I guess the second question was just to follow up from one of the questions which had been asked previously, and which is with regard to the non-performing loans which have been identified as part of the credit review process. Is there a specific timeline for some of those NPLs to be adequately classified and provisioned against within the context of this exercise? Thank you.
On the first question about the DTAs, if I understand correctly, you are referring to some national laws to convert the DTAs to assets, permanent assets guaranteed by the states, which might be called DTCs, but we like to call them these assets. These kind of legal changes have taken place in a couple of countries, for instance, Italy, Spain, Portugal. In the case of Greece, the law that allows this is not yet in effect, so that impact is not in our exercise. But for the other three countries, this impact has been accounted in the findings. I will hand over to Julian if he would like to explain it a bit further.
No, I think the only thing I have to add on this is that as the Greek law is not yet implemented, also the implications for capital plans are not yet set, of course, and there will be specific examinations of how they will be taken into account.
Thank you. Could we go to the next question, please?
If you'd like to ask a question, please press star followed by one. The next question is from the line of Mark Burrows of RBC.
Hi, it's actually Fiona Swaffield from RBC. I'm just asking on behalf of the team. Just a couple of questions. Firstly, can we just go back to this AQR adjustment, the 43 billion that you mentioned? Is there a scenario where some of the banks have already taken this in their accounts in the first 9 months, and that might explain why the press releases we're seeing at the moment aren't talking about big adjustments in the accounts? And could you talk about whether that's a factor? And the second issue is really on the fair value adjustment, so the kind of market risk part of the AQR, which is quite a small number. Has there been any account taken for where banks have changed their assets to the loan books in 2008-2009, or is this just all to do with trading books? Because there are some banks that have got some differences in valuations which don't seem to be being picked up.
If I take the first question and then I hand over to Jan on the fair value adjustments, regarding the AQR adjustments, the number is 48 billion. The 43 was the CFR, the credit file review, and the collective provisions. It is indeed true that banks may have already reflected a significant part in their accounts. We have not reviewed that, and the banks have some information to understand what part of the AQR findings they have already covered and what part they have not covered, but I believe that they don't necessarily have the complete information, and the banks will be studying that. So I think banks will be providing some information what part of the adjustment has already been provided for.
Yeah, in terms of the assets that were transferred in 2008-2009 from fair value to effectively accrual accounted, they were treated in the exercise as if they were accrual accounted. So some of those assets would have been selected in the original portfolio selection and then would have been assessed according with the accounting rules for those exercises. Obviously, given that the sort of fair value discount on them would have been frozen when they were transferred, there wasn't a fair value assessment of part of the exercise.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Next question is from the line of Carlos Perez of BPI.
Hi, good afternoon. Just a very quick question. This one is basically regarding the restructuring plans that banks will have to submit. My question is basically, in those circumstances where the stress test projections are in a bank where the adverse scenario basically led the bank to a shortfall, but the 2014 pre-provisioning profit estimates were already very below the numbers that bank has reported already in the 9 months, Would that gap, that additional earnings or the earnings outperformance that they had vis-à-vis adverse scenario be considered as a mitigating factor for the restructuring plans in order to cover the shortfall that was identified? Thank you very much.
I think there is no real difference between the banks that are in the restructuring or banks that are not in restructuring. In the same way, the shortfall has been identified. The restructuring banks have also been subject to the stress test. The only difference is that if they had the restructuring plans approved before the end of 2013, they did only the dynamic balance sheet assumption in the stress test, and if after the end of 2013 they did both the static and the dynamic, so we take into account the dynamic balance sheet impact as in the case of the Greek banks. But for all banks, now in the next phase, there will be an evaluation of the retained earnings. And, of course, if the retained earnings are coming from the, let's say, structural improvements in profitability within the restructuring plans, that will be then taken into account when we look at the capital plans. But there's no difference between banks. All the banks are required to submit these capital plans. And as we have said, the disclosures we made today were not in the position to disclose any of these measures because we were not in the position to verify retained earnings or other measures that can have an impact on the bank's capital needs at the end of the exercise.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mia, are there any other callers or questions?
We have no further questions so far. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one. So we have a further question from Lee Street of Citibank. Please go ahead.
Hello, good afternoon, and thank you for hosting the call. Just to follow up on a question that has been asked before, in terms of the recognition of additional non-performing exposures identified as part of the AQR and the associated provision, I think you said that you can't force banks to recognise them all, but you expect a significant amount to be recognised. But my question is that as the future supervisor, why wouldn't you be requiring banks to recognise all of the additional NPLs found and provisions, either directly or potentially via an additional capital add-on? That's my question. Thank you.
To clarify, when I spoke about the impact on accounts, I was referring to the provisioning requirements coming from the AQR, not the recognition of the NPEs. Now, what we did in the disclosures was that we published the NPEs coming out of the exercise in order the markets to have information on asset quality on a consistent basis. So I think this was the main purpose of the disclosure of these figures. But from the bank's accounting perspective, the issue is more related to the provisions, and there we will have the process, what I mentioned, to go through with the banks the needs to reflect the provisions in the accounts.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mia. So please let us know if there are any final questions as our time is nearly up.
There are no further questions.
Okay, Mia, thank you. And thank you all for taking time out of your Sunday today to participate in this call. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, the conference is now concluded and you may disconnect your telephone. Thank you for joining and have a pleasant day. Goodbye.